Welcome to The Upper Hand, where Chuck and Chris talk hand surgery.
We are two hand surgeons at Washington University in St. Louis, here to talk about all aspects of hand surgery, from technical to personal.
Thank you for subscribing wherever you get your podcasts.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Oh, hey, Chris.
Hey, Chuck. How are you?
Fantastic. Super duper. How are you?
Oh, I am just okay. I'm fine. Super excited. Today's episode was requested by one of our residents, Dr. Paul Inklin, who is not going into hand, but somehow was still listening to the podcast. I guess he just loved his rotation with me that much, but is currently applying to sports medicine fellowships. He requested that we have a talk about five-ish hand surgeries that non-hand surgeons should know how to do. So that'll be today's topic. But before we launch into that, I wanted to read a review, if that's okay.
Please do. And I thank Paul for his suggestion of topics. And we are always interested in the listener suggestions for future hand podcast topics. But please read the review.
Well, this review is from Sarah. She's a CHT in Texas. And thank you for leaving a wonderful five-star review. And it says, I'm not a podcaster, but your podcast is something I look forward to each week on my drive home from clinic. I admire each of you and appreciate your time and effort on this endeavor. My CHT brain loves every single minute. I learn valuable tidbits in each episode. My passion for hand therapy leads me to grow and learn, and your podcast is perfect for me. I appreciate hearing your rationale for certain procedures, and most importantly, appreciate your respect for the current as well as past research, which Chuck has written all of. I added that. Thank you so much for all you do for your patients and your community. And she was kind enough to share information about the podcast with her favorite hand surgeon in the great state of Texas. So Sarah, thank you for the review. Thank you for listening and for spreading the word.
Thank you, Sarah. Super kind. And we appreciate your writing in as well as being a listener. Chris, I heard through the grapevine that you had an interesting fellow-centered dinner on Friday night. I'd love to hear more.
We did. It was with a local financial services company, I guess I should say. And interestingly enough, the way that we got connected is that the gentleman who reached out used to be a hand surgeon. I guess once a hand surgeon, always a hand surgeon, but he's no longer practicing. And he practiced in our community here in St. Louis and was an incredibly well-respected surgeon, knows our partner Marty Boyer fairly well. And I guess he had reached out to Marty and they were talking about financial planning. He, in this stage of his career, is the vice president of this company. Name is PlanCor. And he works for PlanCor, and he wanted to reach out to our fellows about just talking about personal finance and kind of all the things that we touched upon in our prior episode. He actually listened to our episode, and I actually don't remember exactly everything that I mentioned and you mentioned in that. But there were some good suggestions that we also got in follow-up emails that we should go through as well. But we had a dinner. It was really interesting. Coincidentally, one of our non-operative sports medicine doctors, Kayla Daniel, is married to one of the PlanCor advisors. So I got to hang out with Kayla at dinner. It was great.
Yes, I love it. I love it for a couple of reasons. One, Kayla and I were talking yesterday, and that's how I knew about this discreet dinner. I didn't get an invitation to it. Just kidding. I love that we have in the last few, for a long time, I've been giving coding and personal finance lectures to the fellows, and plan to continue. Marty joined me last year for that, and we'll probably continue to do that. And there's no one recipe, but it's just so important. When you are a trainee, you are hopefully locked in on one thing, and that is learning your craft. And the other stuff is incredibly important and can't be neglected. And this is, it's really great that you guys did this, and hopefully the fellows all appreciated it.
Yeah, no, I appreciate the way that Bob at PlanCor set this up. It was pretty free-flowing conversation. Clearly, there are obviously points they wanted to address, it was good because I think it just gave our fellows and myself as well stuff to think about. Many of them, I think, already have kind of their setup, but doesn't mean you can't re-examine your philosophy and the services that you use. So yes, it was a nice dinner, and it was made better because they asked me to talk about the podcast a lot.
I love it. I know you said, look, I carry the podcast. Gopharp's not at dinner because he doesn't carry his share of the weight.
Because Gopharp's editing the podcast. That's actually why he's not at dinner.
What I think, actually, what you just said is interesting, not to get too waylaid by this topic, but I think it's interesting. So I have used one financial services company for a long time. And I've been very happy with them. They're conservative, but not ridiculously conservative. But interestingly, I have reexamined what I'm doing in the last year or so. I've started to do some different things in addition to that. And so you're right. It's not something that should be inflexible and not, you know, different companies have different principles and how they handle things. And so just to put your head down and say, oh, my finance guys have it, that's naive. And so continually reexamining the process and how you and your family handle it is really important.
Yeah. And we've had listeners write in saying that, you know, you don't need to have somebody do that for you. You should totally do it yourself. And everybody's got their own perspective. I personally don't have the bandwidth for it. You know, as we have discussed in the last episode, I really don't even have the bandwidth to look at my codes. So I can't keep an eye on all that stuff. But yes, I mean, you are paying, a fair bit of money to have somebody manage your money. And in many cases, you get what you pay for. But there are many surgeons, I think, and therapists that are able to do this on their own, and more power to you.
Yeah, I think that's right. And again, my whole principle is don't be egotistical about this. You know, we as surgeons and therapists are not smarter than our financial colleagues. They have spent more time, are able to spend more time daily on this. And so, yes, we can choose to do this ourselves. But if you choose that route, you know, you need to take the time to do it right. So I really enjoy this aspect of life, but I do generally have others handle it for me.
So let's get to Paul's topic. So Paul suggested 5 hand surgeries that non-hand surgeons should know how to do. What comes to mind?
Yeah, I think it's a really interesting topic. And you and I are both probably going to come off a little snobbish here.
Just me.
Mm-hmm. So let's start with a nerve surgery because nerve surgeries aren't that special, right? Let's start with carpal tunnel. I think a carpal tunnel can be done by those in other fields. The hand surgeon approaches a carpal tunnel release with respect and really a principled approach. And as long as others who may choose to do this procedure do the same, I think good outcomes can be expected. Perhaps a little bigger incision, which is fine. Perhaps a little different postoperative protocol, which is fine. But it can't be a slash and burn technique, so to speak. It's got to be done with respect, and good outcomes should be and, you know, really expected. And I think they absolutely can be obtained. So I think any well-trained hand surgeon, plastic surgeon, general surgeon, and some might say neurosurgeon, because there are plenty of neurosurgeons doing carpal tunnel releases, can do this procedure.
Do you think they need to do it with loops?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I can't do a femur fracture without loops. And so that's one end of the spectrum. No, I don't think you need loops.
Yeah, I think that, you know, from an access to care perspective, yes, this surgery should be done by any board, or should be able to be done by any board eligible, board certified orthopedic surgeon, plastic surgeon, theoretically general surgeon and neurosurgeon too. Because there are going to be many practice settings in which you're the general, and not to exclude plastics or anything, but you know, you're the general orthopod for the community. And you should know how to do carpal tunnel release because it's a common procedure with reliable and predictable outcomes. So yes, I think that a carpal tunnel should be on that list for sure.
Yeah, the only caveat I would say is if you are a surgeon who does this procedure intermittently, you know, some hand surgeons will do 5 or 10 a week. And if you're doing 1 or 2 a month, I might argue, and again, some will disagree with me, I might argue it shouldn't be done endoscopically. I would argue that endoscopic may or may not have a higher risk. I personally believe it does. The literature doesn't necessarily confirm that. But I would say if you're intermittently doing this procedure, do it with an open technique or mini open technique. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, but I think I have my bias of not having spent a lot of time with endoscopic. As we talked about in a prior episode, I'm looking at using an ultrasound guided one. But again, that also is not a procedure that should be done if you don't know how to do a solid open carpal tunnel release, because you don't appreciate what you're seeing unless you have a healthy respect for the open anatomy. And again, not like you're seeing all these structures when you're doing a mini open carpal tunnel release, but you need to respect them.
Yeah, I think that's a good pivot to another procedure. And the reason I say it's a good pivot is part of meeting patient expectations is setting patient expectations. So carpal tunnel is not foolproof, and not every patient has a perfect result. Part of it is making the diagnosis and confirming the diagnosis. And while trigger finger is simpler in every respect, many of us fall into the trap of thinking 100% of trigger finger releases will do perfectly. And while the vast, vast majority do, there can be scar tissue, there can be recurrence. And so that's another procedure I think a generalist can and should do. But again, with at least a modicum of respect for the procedure.
Right. When do you think trigger fingers go south? When do you think that, is it an intraoperative thing? Is it just how patients respond to the scar? Like who is unhappy after a trigger finger release?
You know, I believe David Ring tried to look at this, and as I recall, it was like 2% of patients were not happy after. I think that feels about right. I usually tell patients 1 out of 20 will not get the result that they want or I want, and I usually believe it's related to scar tissue. I try to be very, regimented in how I do it and what I release. I don't think it's about that. It's one of those deals, same approach, same retraction, same sharp release every time. But ignoring complications, I think there's a very small percentage that make scar tissue and don't do great. I will say what I've become convinced of is if you're doing three triggers, I won't say two, but if you're doing three or four triggers, I think the risk of that scar tissue less than perfect outcome markedly increases.
Do you think it's scar tissue around the tendon or scar tissue at the incision?
Both.
Okay.
What do you think?
I caution patients mainly that I think that the scar, the painful scar, is probably the biggest thing, and it's going to feel sore and tender for quite some time. And most people are over that by a month. But there is the occasional patient, and it's uncommon, but if you're that one, it matters a lot. Still have soreness there. And I have one patient in my mind who, kind of sticks out as having that issue in however many years that I've been doing this. You told me I'm not allowed to call myself young anymore. So
someone else said that, not me, but I agree with it.
Right. I don't know. I mean, I think that I think this is one of the surgeries where there is such an advantage to having people awake. In terms of being able to assess for any areas where the tendon may not be completely released and there's still some triggering. Now, it's uncommon that, when I have the patients move their finger, that there's any triggering or catching, but it comes up once every few months. And that's enough for me to say, thank God I do these awake.
I think that's really well said. And I totally agree with you. Even though I don't do all of them, I do the vast majority now awake. Same with my carpal tunnels.
So what's the third procedure that you think a non-hand surgeon, a generalist, so to say, should know how to do?
Distoradius fracture. And, distoradius fractures are really a bread and butter procedure for all hand surgeons. But we also have come to respect the injury and respect the challenges. And again, it gets back to being able to predict possible complications and doing what we can to minimize those. So, a simple, quote unquote, simple Colles fracture with a volar plate can have complications. And so, do you drill both cortices and where do you put your plate? All those things matter. But having said all of that, I think for the not crazy comminuted multiple fragment intra-articular fracture, I think that is a procedure that many others can do and do well.
Yeah, and many do. I mean, there are tremendous regional and institutional variations in who takes care of distal radius. At some places, it's the trauma service. I remember in training when I was a resident, trauma service would take care of all the acute distal radius fractures. I think the things that they care about are different than the things that hand surgeons care about. And I was looking back at my binder of fluoroscopy from when I was a trauma when I was on the trauma service as a resident. And I looked at some of those constructs. I'm like, I would not have done that this way. And I would not have accepted this. But there were also some very thoughtful things that, those trauma surgeons did. So just different approaches and different priorities, I think. What are the distal radius fracture patterns that you think should be handled by only hand surgeons?
One that may have an accompanying ligament injury, although some would argue that, if you're concerned about an SL injury, do we address that at the same time? Although some would argue ignore it.
There's some good literature out there suggesting that.
Yep. A die punch fracture, I think, is one that probably would benefit from a hand surgeon approach. I would say one with an accompanying DRUJ instability. For certain, but a Colles fracture, again, quote unquote, simple two-part fracture. I think those are fine. What about you? What did I miss?
I think that's, I think radiocarpal dislocations, any injuries along that spectrum probably should be treated by a hand surgeon just because we're probably the ones that are going to take them across the finish line. I bet there are lots of cases that are treated well that we never see. I think one difference that I've noticed, and it's in the literature as well, is the threshold to perform adjunct procedures like a carpal tunnel release at the same time. I do a fair bit of carpal tunnel release when I'm fixing a distal radius. Now, it's not common, but I definitely do it more than what I noticed when I was in training, because the trauma service would never do it. Because it just didn't, either it didn't cross their minds or it just didn't come up as part of the injury, for that patient.
Yeah, well said. Really important. I did one this week where distal radius fracture with some early numbness and tingling in the fingers. And while not dramatic, to me, if there's any signs of anything, I'd go ahead and do the carpal tunnel release. So really good point.
I mean, one of our peds ortho partners sent me a patient a few months ago. I was so pleased that they had done a carpal tunnel release at the same time as their distal radius ORIF. I was so happy that they had done it. The patient is going to do great.
Yeah, I think I know who you're talking about, and I agree with you completely. And that's because Lindley and I preached that in our indications conference.
And our residents are so good that they can do it.
Well, that is certainly true. All right, what's next? We've got we talked about carpal tunnel, trigger, distal radius.
I don't know about this one, but I think it's probably true. I think a generalist should know how to fix a metacarpal fracture.
Yeah. I agree. The trickier part might be which metacarpal fractures need fixing, but I agree with that. I mean, especially someone who does a lot of trauma can handle it. Handling the tendons dorsally matters. Newer, slicker techniques might not be used, but newer, slicker techniques might not end up being, the be all and end all. So I agree with that. I mean, again, once you're getting intra-articular ahead of the metacarpal, that's different. But a metacarpal, especially a shaft fracture or a Boxer's fracture that might need treating, I agree with you completely.
Yeah, I mean, from an access to care perspective, I mean, those things come up, they should be fixed. Now when you start to get to the proximal phalanx, that's when I think things start to get a little bit tougher. There are many more considerations in terms of the soft tissues. But yeah, I think a metacarpal should be able to be fixed. Is there anything else on this list as we bring things to a wrap?
Yeah, the one I was thinking about is the one I am not so certain about, and I hope our listeners will weigh in. I don't know about cubital tunnel patients, and some of our shoulder and elbow partners historically have done that, and I'm in no position to tell someone to or not to do a procedure. But again, the problem is indications for procedure, management after, and ideal techniques in. And sure, there are plenty of cubital tunnels that can be decompressed, or the nerve might be transposed that you can expect a good outcome. But in my mind, when the procedure's predicted rate of success lowers, so maybe 80% of the people do great or 70% of the people do great, that's more of an indication for a specialist to handle it. And so I do wonder whether cubital tunnels should be regularly performed by others.
Well, in actuality, I agree with you, but they are being done by others, many, many others. I think that the variability in results after cubital tunnel surgery is concerning. Also, the variability in which surgery you do. You know, we don't agree even as a community of hand surgeons what the right thing to do is. But I think that, you know, for this particular surgery, you should know how to take somebody across the finish line. So what do you do if your first surgery doesn't go well? Are you able to perform the revision and do it well and take care of the patient? That's the way that I think about it. You know, for example, not exactly the same, but I mean, somebody asked me like, what would you want done? Whether if you had cubital tunnel and you were had failed non-operative treatment, would you want a decompression or a transposition? And if I had a stable nerve, I probably would want a decompression done by a surgeon who knows how to do a really good transposition. Because if something doesn't go well, and I'm part of that somewhere between 7 to 20% that needs a revision surgery, I would like to stay with the same surgeon. I want to know that the surgeon knows how to handle a transposition.
Yeah, well said, for sure. And yeah, and I don't mean to suggest that others shouldn't or can't do these procedures. I just, they make me a little nervous. Nervous is the wrong word, but they, you know, I just, again, it goes back to predictability. And I know that there are really skilled surgeons out there who are not hand surgeons who do a great job with this procedure, no doubt about it. But I just don't think it's a procedure that one should perform once or twice a year. And like you said, without the ability to handle what may happen after.
Well, it's a way to end it on a high note there. So we'd love to hear, I mean, for our listeners, you know, hand therapists, are there surgeons that, you know, are there surgeries that you've seen non-hand surgeons do and do it well, or maybe not so well? Love to hear your feedback on that. And then for our, you know, practicing surgeons and trainees, what do you think? Because, you know, if you're a trainee, you got to learn how to do this stuff. And if you're a practicing surgeon, we have some generalists who listen and want to give us their thoughts. So please feel free to either send an email, social media, whatever works best. But yeah, let us know.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And I think that's a really good point. Hand therapists know all, and they see outcomes. They objectively can quantify outcomes. And so nothing's more flattering than getting referrals from a hand therapist, but they do have a very unique perspective.
Oh, it's total flattery. It's like when you get the, when the PACU nurses and the OR nurses start coming to see you. I remember you talking about that as when I was your fellow and seeing that and patients referred from hand therapists or seeing hand therapists themselves as patients is, you know, it's flattering for sure.
Yeah.
So any wins for the week?
So my win for the week is I'm starting to prepare for a couple of meetings. And, you know, I'm not one who wants to travel all the time. But, you know, once a month, every other month, I think that's fine. And I have 3 or 4 meetings coming up and I'm starting to prepare for them. And not that I love the preparation part, but I'm looking forward to it. It feels like, again, one other indicator that we're getting things back to normal. What about you?
You know, I was just thinking I'm more of a slides on the plane and slides in the hotel the day before kind of guy. So, but you clearly have it together much more. You know, I'm really excited. I'm going to make some fried chicken this afternoon and cheeseburgers. My daughter's in love with cheeseburgers and it's the only way that she will eat protein apparently. So I'm going to fire up the grill today and then also do some fried chicken. So I'm super excited about that. It's not a win yet. I hope it ends up being a win, but it's a win in my mind already.
Well, growing up in Alabama, the careful fried chicken creation process I'm interested to see how it comes out. Good luck.
Oh yeah. I'm a big buttermilk guy. I'm going to go put those guys in some buttermilk now. So enjoy the rest of your day and good luck with your meeting prep.
Thank you. Take care.
Hey, Chris, that was fun. Let's do it again real soon.
Sounds good. Well, be sure to check us out on Twitter at Hand Podcast. Hey, Chuck, what's your Twitter handle?
Mine is at Congenital Hand. What about you?
Mine is at Chris DMD, spelled DY. And if you'd like to email us, you can reach us at handpodcast@gmail.com.
And remember, please subscribe wherever you get your podcast.
And be sure to leave a review. That helps us get the word out.
Special thanks to Peter Martin for the amazing music. And remember, keep the upper hand. Come back next time.